From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the January 2015 edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. This month we're looking at crucial contributions, that of the Polish mathematicians whose work proved invaluable in the breaking of Enigma at the start of World War II. The contribution made by each and every person who worked at Bletchley Park, like Roseanne Colchester. This month, she shares her memories of what she's called that terrible war. We'll hear what happened when a plaque was unveiled at the site of a bomb outstation in Eastcote. And take one last look back at 2014 at what a bumper year it's been for the Oral History Project, gathering veterans' precious first-hand memories for future generations. And we'll look ahead at what's new this year with Bletchley Park's Director of Learning and Collections, Victoria Warpole. But first, the hit film about Alan Turing, The Imitation Game, has been nominated for 8 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Actor and Best Supporting Actress. The film starring Benedict Cumberbatch as the luminary codebreaker and Keira Knightley as his friend, colleague and fiancée Joan Clarke is also the subject of an exciting exhibition at Bletchley Park, in the very room where pivotal scenes were shot. The 87th Academy Awards will be held in Los Angeles on the 22nd of February.
Are you paying attention?
Based on the incredible true story.
Who are you?
Alan Turing.
It's an instant classic.
Welcome to Enigma.
It's unbreakable.
A superb thriller, 5 stars.
What if only a machine can defeat another machine?
Enigma will not save you.
You've got more secrets than the best of them.
The Imitation Game, in cinemas now.
Back in November, relatives of Poland's code-breaking geniuses visited Bletchley Park to celebrate their contribution to the battle to break Enigma. In July 1939, a secret meeting took place in the Piri Forest outside Warsaw. History was made at that meeting. Today, the families of the 3 geniuses, whose work proved invaluable in the breaking of Enigma, are able to tell their story with pride.
Getting ambassador, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Bletchley Park. I'm Ian Standen. It's my pleasure today to welcome you for this visit. The visit, as you'll know, started from the visit by the director of GCHQ to Warsaw back in the summer to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the very important sharing of the intelligence that went on between Poland, France and Britain prior to the start of the Second World War and allowed the team who finally assembled here at Bletchley Park at the start of the Second World War to have a good head start in the work they were doing in breaking into the German Enigma cipher, work that was so crucial to the intelligence production right from the earliest days of the Second World War in this place here. And I think I've said enough in terms of how important the Anglo-Polish-Franco cooperation was in terms of starting off the war here. I'm going to pass over to Darius. When he has finished, we'll then take you round on a walk through the park. We have some Polish-related artefacts to show you, and very importantly, we'll finish up at the Polish Memorial for a wreath laying, and then I think a second wreath will lay at the British Memorial to those who served, before returning to here for some luncheons.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is a memorable occasion for us all as the families of distinguished Polish cryptologists of Marian Rejewski, Jerzy Różycki and Henryk Zygalski are received here at Bletchley Park, the center of the British code breaking. In the autumn of 1939, Bletchley Park began to draw on information which Poles had provided shortly before the war. Alan Turing and his co-workers based their initial work on the Polish concepts, including the Zygalski sheets and the Rejewski bomb. We are proud of the Polish contribution to the coding of the Enigma, and we are delighted that this contribution has been recognized here at Bletchley Park. Without your cooperation between Polish and British cryptologists, German codes might not have been broken, and as a result, the Second World War may have lasted much longer. I would like to thank everyone who organized this tour, both on the British and the Polish side. We also thank the families of Marian Rejewski, Jerzy Różycki, and Henryk Zygalski for accepting this invitation. I hope you will enjoy your stay in Bletchley Park and, of course, in London. Thank you.
My name's Tony Comer. I'm the departmental historian at GCHQ. We're very happy today to welcome the families of the Polish mathematicians and cryptanalysts who did so much work against the Enigma system used by the Germans before the Second World War. The French, the British, and the Poles were all working against Enigma, and each brought different skills to the task. But it was only in July 1939 that the three countries actually met outside Warsaw and exchanged all of the information they had. It was a tremendous surprise to the British and the French that the Poles were much further ahead than either of them. This is probably because the Poles had had a different approach to cryptanalysis. The Poles had employed mathematicians and had studied Enigma as principally a mathematical problem. It was like a relay race. The Poles had run the first lap and had got much further and much faster than anyone had expected. And then they passed the baton to the British and French cryptanalysts. In January 1940, Alan Turing, who had been made aware of the progress made by the Poles after the meeting in July 1939, travelled to Paris. He wanted to meet the Polish cryptanalysts, who by that time had left Poland and were working in Paris, because he wanted to explore the mathematics that underpinned the work that had been done. And it was a result of that series of conversations in January 1940 that enabled him to formulate his ideas for the cryptanalytic bomb designed to recover Enigma settings. That then was in place in time for the Battle of Britain, providing crucial intelligence and, in an irony, not just providing intelligence to British forces, to the Royal Air Force, but also to the Polish squadrons of the Royal Air Force, who played such a crucial part in that battle. Today's story really isn't about competition, about which country achieved what and when. It's a story of partnership. It's a story of how the Poles took the lead and passed on their knowledge to the British, how the British were able to build on that knowledge, build on the very solid foundation that the Poles had created, and eventually produce the crucial intelligence that was of use to both Polish and British forces throughout the Second World War.
Okay, this is the stable yard at Bletchley Park, which is where the early code-breaking team were based. So the materials and the ideas that were handed over by Poland to Britain would have arrived in this building to be worked on. We have to acknowledge several other Polish people involved in this story. Libria Szyfru, its head, Guido Langer, and his colleague Maximilian Siawski.
Yes,
it was, from what I understand, Siawski's idea to bring mathematicians into this work. And the course that the 26 young Polish mathematicians attended was taught by Antoni Palow. And particularly important, the fact that Langer and Siawski were captured by the Germans in 1944. Heroically, they managed to convince the Germans that they had not been able to break the German military enigma. And as I'm sure you know, Rejewski and Zygalski eventually made it through Spain to Britain in late 1943. And for the rest of the war worked at a place called Boxmoor, a mere 27 miles from where we're standing.
invite you now to come and lay a wreath at the memorial here.
We're standing in Bletchley Park in the Buckinghamshire countryside, about 50 miles from London. Bletchley Park was chosen by the head of MI6 in 1937-38 to be the British government's war station for intelligence activity. The war station officially opened on August 15, 1939, from a small number of about 200 people. By the end of the war, some 10,500 people were employed by the organization based here throughout the war. Before they arrived at Bletchley Park, the British cryptanalysts, led by a veteran World War I codebreaker by the name of Billy Knox, knew that the German military had adopted the Enigma machine, made it more secure, and were using it to encrypt their operational communications. But Knox was not making any headway with this machine. His main problem was he could not work out how either the wheels inside it were wired or other wiring issues in the machine. So he was, in effect, stuck. Fortunately, the Polish codebreakers had deduced the wiring of the machine. Eminently, Marian Rejewski, who had worked all this out using a very elegant mathematical theory called the permutation theory. Shortly before Poland was invaded by Germany, a conference was held at a place called Piri at the Biuro Szyfrów's secret headquarters outside of Warsaw. And at that meeting, attended by Alistair Denniston, who ran Bletchley Park during the war, Billy Knox, chief cryptanalyst, and a chap called Humphrey Sandwith, who was the British Admiralty's head of radio intelligence. All of the Polish methods were handed over to the British, including the wiring of the Enigma machine. This information was sent back to Britain, and shortly after the Government Code and Cipher School arrived at Bletchley Park in late August 1939, the first Enigma encrypted message was read in Great Britain. It was read by one of Knox's team using information provided by the Poles and a message that the Polish intercept service had intercepted. From that point on, the Polish methods were adopted by Bletchley Park and used quite successfully for about 4 or 5 months. They scaled them up and they used them very, very effectively. Unfortunately, the Polish methods were based entirely on a German procedural error. The people here were concerned that the mistake was obvious enough that the Germans would recognize that it was not a secure method. And at the beginning of May 1940, the Germans started to change their procedures, and eventually the Polish methods became obsolete, could no longer be used. Bletchley Park needed to come up with its own methods and solutions. But the ideas provided by the Polish codebreakers gave the codebreakers of Bletchley Park a huge advance, probably saved anything up to 6 months in time, and a lot of the ideas and the inspiration, particularly the confidence that this system could be broken, and the use of mathematicians to do the work. So the Polish contribution was hugely significant to the work and ultimate success of Bletchley Park.
I am Anna Zygalska-Kanon, Henryk Zygalski's niece. I live in this country, in Great Britain, and try to bring his memory to the new generations of Poles living in England and also to the Britons whom I meet.
I am Jeremy Russell, the nephew of Henryk Zygalski, and I am a retired doctor. I live in Donington near Newbury. I'm very proud of my uncle Henryk, although when I was a child I was actually quite scared of him with his shock of hair and his dark black horn-rimmed glasses. But as I grew to know him better as a young adult, I really loved him and we had a lot of good times together. He taught me a lot, particularly about classical music and how to play chess. I miss him even now.
I unfortunately do not have such personal memories of my Uncle Henryk, but that is made up for everything I have found out about him from quite a lot of correspondence that was left behind after he died. And I have learned to get to know him, both him and his wife, Bertha, very closely, it feels to me. And that makes it much more personal for me to be able to popularize his achievement and also him as a living person to the next generations. For instance, my daughter, as I'm sure Jeremy's children are as well, is very, very proud of her great uncle Henryk. and is telling her friends, everybody she meets, how important it was. So that definitely does resonate with the young generation of both Britons in this country and also with the young generation of Polish. They're also quite aware of the fact that it was the Polish mathematicians, code breakers, cryptologists who first broke the secret and who contributed so much. And this is something that all Polish people can be proud of. And everybody in his family can be proud of.
Yes. One of the biggest regrets in my life is not being sufficiently aware of his work at an age when I could talk to him about it and ask him about it, because he never talked about it spontaneously. And sadly, at the age of 60, he had a stroke. And for the next 10 years until he died, he was really less and less able to communicate. So I lost a valuable opportunity to find out firsthand more of what he did before the war and during the war.
Of course, our visit was made even more enjoyable that it was not just the two of us, nephew and niece of Henryk Zygalski, but also the family of Henryk Zygalski from Poland, Marylka and Gerhard Bryszak. Marylka is Henryk's niece. So Henryk's family was very well represented here today. But we were accompanied, to our great joy, on the visit by the descendants of the other two Polish mathematicians, Marian Rejewski's daughter, Janina, Pani Janina Sylwestrzak, and also there was Mr. Różycki, who is the son of Jerzy Różycki, the third member of the group. The meeting today, for which we are very grateful to all our hosts, starting with the Polish Embassy and GCHQ and the hosts here at Bletchley Park. We are very happy because you joining us here today have cemented all the family ties that we all feel. Our three relatives lived and worked together in close proximity in all their difficult journeys through Romania, France, eventually Algeria, Spain. And I'm sure that created great bonds between them for so many years. They lived in very, very dangerous circumstances. They played football, they went on excursions, they cycled together, they saw the sights. They were far away from their own families, and they created a little family bond between them that we are now very happy to inherit as their descendants.
...2014 was a landmark year at Bletchley Park with the completion of an £8 million restoration project. So what does 2015 have in store? I'm with Bletchley Park's Director of Learning and Collections, Victoria Walpole. Now hopefully you can tell me what's coming up in 2015.
Yes, we've got some exciting new exhibitions to open this year, starting with Hut 12, which we're putting a temporary exhibition into, and our curator Gillian Mason has been working hard to put together an exhibition about the regeneration of the site over the last year. And in there will be archaeology that was found and code breaking materials that we found stuffed into the eaves in the huts.
So these are things that people didn't think anybody would ever be interested in, but now of course we are, and it gives us great insight, doesn't it?
Yes, it's quite rare for us to find new paperwork, because any paperwork that survived is either in our archive or at GCHQ or at the National Archive. So to find actual materials that were used by the code breakers, shoved into between beams and, you know, cracks in the woodwork, is really exciting for us. And we've actually had a conservator work on the materials to make sure we preserve them as best we can. So it's been very interesting.
I bet someone who scribbled on a piece of paper and shoved it in the eaves to keep warm or for whatever reason it was would laugh to think that they're working. So, well, when you finish your notes now, you don't think, I'll keep those for posterity. In 70 years, people will be looking at those in a glass case.
No, it's
quite... When you've just finished with anything, it doesn't have any perceived value, does it?
No, and it's quite interesting to think that these were, you know, actual handwritten pieces of code breaking, workings out. There are some materials, we don't know what they are, and nobody seems to know what they are, so it's unveiling a mystery, as it were. And in fact, we've sent things off to GCHQ and various other experts, and there are a number of items that really, at the moment, we are yet to understand properly. There is one item going into Hut 12, which we found during the restoration of the huts, which we're very excited about because it's a Turing-related object, and it's never been seen before.
Mm.
Ooh, watch this space. Well, here we are now at Hut 12, where this exhibition will be. That's opening when?
It will open very early in the spring.
And it's locked for now. I can see that there's work in development underway there. Here we are in Hut 8 then. What's happening in here?
Well, as you know, Hut 8 was part of Project Neptune, and we've installed interactives in some of these rooms which demonstrate code-breaking principles. One of the exhibitions that we took out from Hut 8 before was about the HMS Petard and the story around the very brave sailors on that boat. And we're going to reinstall that exhibition in some form. It won't look as it did previously, but we're going to use one of the empty rooms in here to describe the pinch, as we believe a pinch is a sort of code-breaking principle.
Tell me what a pinch is.
It's where you take code books or paraphernalia to do with code-breaking from a submarine or a
seizing it.
Or, yes.
Okay, yeah. Pinching it.
Yep.
As we approach Block C then, this has been a huge innovation this year, opening up a new visitor centre. But we're not done yet, are we?
No, we still have Spur 9 in this building to complete. And we're very excited this year to have our World War I exhibition opening in Spur 9. And we're excited because it's the sort of beginning of the Bletchley Park story. Obviously, there was code breaking going on in World War I. Two main organisations carrying that work out, Room 40 and MI1B. And they came together at the end of World War I and formed the Government Code and Cipher School, which of course was the precursor to Bletchley Park. So that's a very important part of our story, because a number of characters who were codebreakers in World War I moved here in World War II.
That unified approach was very new thinking, wasn't it?
Definitely. At the beginning of World War I and during World War I to a degree, there was a lot of separation between those two organisations, and the sharing of information only began at a point when it had to happen, really. And so the joining properly of the two organisations at the end of World War I was quite a significant event. And we have organograms drawn up by the two organisations about who they thought should be in charge and how they thought things should be happening, which are quite interesting reading. So they'll be going into the exhibition.
It's fascinating. Some of the key people involved in World War I went on to become quite important here, and that's a major part of this exhibition, isn't it, about those people?
Yes, it is a lot about people in this story. So people like Dilly Knox, he was a codebreaker in World War I, and we have quite a significant area in the exhibition which demonstrates Dilly's methods in quite an interesting way, which I'm not going to give away, but it's a very unusual element to the exhibition. Denniston was a World War I codebreaker, Frank Birch, and so on. I think there's about 10 or 12 who moved over to Bletchley Park when World War II started.
And then a whole wave of new thinking began again, because of course then by the time World War II got underway, they started to approach the problem with mathematicians rather than just linguists and that classical approach.
Yes, and in World War I, of course, there weren't machines making codes and ciphers as such. They were tending to use code books and those sorts of things, and then a form of enciphering sometimes after the use of code books. So it was a different challenge in World War I, but still a challenge. And there were many less people working on code breaking in World War I. You know, there were around 100 people in Room 40.
And there's going to be a sort of a bookending of the Bletchley Park story by the time the World War I exhibition is up and running, because you go across the way into another spur, straight opposite, and you're in the cybersecurity exhibition. Is there more development coming here this year as well?
There will be parts of this exhibition being made into an online exhibition this year, which we're quite excited about. So people will be accessing the information. And some of the interactives we're hoping to make into a version that we can take out and about this year. We're also purchasing some handheld devices this year for use in the education programme, which are devices that the students can be given at the start of the session. And then when there's a question or a part of the session they have where they interact, they can do it with the keypad. Now, that's particularly useful for the online safety sessions, because the students can respond in a way where nobody knows who's saying what. So, you know, if you ask a question like, how many of you have a Facebook account, and they're 10-year-olds, They know they're not supposed to have a Facebook account at that age. If you're doing anonymous feedback via these handsets, and you're more likely to get an honest response.
And their teachers and their friends aren't seeing how they're
answering.
And that's really good.
And they can be used in all of our school sessions. You can program them to go with any presentation, and you know, we can ask students if they enjoyed the session and they can respond in an anonymous way. That's very valuable for us.
Okay, what else is coming up this year?
We're changing our schools programme quite significantly this year. The primary school sessions will be rejuvenated and there will be a number of new sessions offered to schools. Our Turing Education Officer Joanna is in charge of creating the new sessions, and the volunteers are working on the materials that go with the sessions so that we can deliver sessions that relate directly to the curriculum and provide what teachers are asking for. We're also formalising our secondary school sessions so that we can offer a standardised approach to schools, so they know that when they come in, the materials they're being given are the same as the second group that are coming in the next day, and so on and so forth. And to deliver all these new sessions, we're also recruiting to our education department.
So Bletchley Park needs you, basically.
Yes, definitely. We're hoping to bring in a whole tranche of new volunteers to support the current volunteers who are doing an amazing job, but the more schools we attract, the more volunteers we need.
Just so with visitors as well, the more people come through the gates and the more people come to experience and enjoy Bletchley Park, the more help we need making the most of that experience for all of them.
Definitely, and the school sessions particularly require a person. We are delivering do-it-yourself sessions for schools and we have new materials that are going on the website, but it's always good to have a knowledgeable person available for schools if they would like to ask questions or if they'd like a code-breaking session. It always enhances the visit.
So what are your hopes for this year overall?
My hopes for this year are that we continue to update and improve all the exhibitions, keep them fresh, replace anything that needs replacing. As you know, the huts are open to everybody to walk round and have a good look, and for that reason we have to replenish the materials.
A few casualties.
Yeah. Pencils particularly become casualties. But also our schools programme, which has been amazingly supported so far, just needs to continue to grow because we're oversubscribed all the time. We have to find new ways to enable more and more students and young people to come through and get a glimpse of the amazing work that was done here and be inspired to do those subjects at school. You know, science, technology, engineering and maths definitely are things that we can promote here, so that's what we're hoping to do.
Well, here's to another great year.
The 1940s boutique returns to Bletchley Park on Saturday the 7th of February, ready to face 2015 in iconic vintage style. Learn to recreate the glamorous 1940s look, including the red lips that kept secrets of national importance and victory rolls. Vintage stylist Sarah Dunn of Sarah's Do What Do's teaches a full day's workshop with a chance to absorb Bletchley Park's unique atmosphere and learn about World War II code-breaking to boot. Book now, the last few tickets remain. And on the 15th of March, Bletchley Park presents Michael Smith, the best-selling author, whose new book, The Debs of Bletchley Park, is out now. Tickets are on sale. A memorial plaque has been unveiled at the site of the outstation at Eastcote, where bomb machines were housed and operated by Wrens. There representing Bletchley Park were Oral History Officer Jonathan Byrne and podcast producer Mark Cotton. After the ceremony, they chatted about what's been a bumper year for the Oral History Project.
So here we are, Jonathan, down in Block C, in front of one of the new Roll of Honour kiosks. And there's a couple of these in the park, isn't there?
Yes, well, there's one here in Block C and another one up in the mansion. And also in the mansion, we've got the bound copy, the official copy, provided for us by GCHQ. It goes back several years. Before I was doing it, I've been doing it for about 4 years. Excellent work by volunteers before me, and then I picked it up. The aim of the Roll of Honour is to record everybody who worked for Britain, the Commonwealth, in signals intelligence in the Second World War. And we've now got over 10,500 names on it. And believe it or not, 70 years on, we're adding more. As more people are found out about, a lot of them are still living. They come to us, or their children come to us and say, my mother, my father was at Bletchley Park. Are you interested in hearing from them? And of course we are, and we add their details to the Roll of Honour.
I think things like The Imitation Game and Bletchley Circle, they've helped really, haven't they? Because they've actually helped with the next generation, where it's the children or the grandchildren who suddenly go, oh, didn't Grandma say something about working at Bletchley Park? And then that starts a conversation for them, doesn't it? And we're the benefactors of it, aren't we?
Yeah, that's quite right. A lot of the veterans are reluctant to talk about it. It was just something they did many years ago. They were told not to talk about it, of course.
They didn't.
And we have to remind them they can talk about it now. It's official from the highest level. A lot, unfortunately, passed away before they were able to talk about it. But in many cases, they wrote private memoirs. They told their children, their friends and family what they'd done. And with permission of their family, we can often use those on the Roll of Honour as little articles or elsewhere in the museum to help tell their story.
What, even people who passed away?
Oh, yes. We obviously check that family are happy for us to do it. And they're always delighted, quite frankly. Some of these ones written a few years ago, probably on the assumption no one would ever read it, are fascinating. Mm. Occasionally there's the odd detail in we might have to tone down because they're a little bit frank about some of the people they worked with. But that's great, that's all part of the human story.
They're probably more honest in a way than they would have because they thought they wouldn't be published.
I think that's true because it was secret and to them it remains secret. And it gets a good feel of what life was like here at Bletchley Park, wherever else they were working, or in wartime life in general.
Mm. It's so important because in many ways, these first-hand histories are the only way we can tell the story of Bletchley Park. And that's what we're here for, fundamentally, is to tell those stories of the work that was done here between 1939 and 1945, when it was GC and CS.
Yeah, that's quite right. But unlike so many other areas of wartime activities, it wasn't filmed, very few photographs were taken, there are very few contemporary accounts. Many of the original documents were destroyed many years ago, probably because they thought they weren't needed anymore, particularly personnel records, because by the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, it was still secret. There's no point in keeping all these old files because no one's ever going to know about it. Now, 70 years on, we're having to catch up with what we should have learnt 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. Mm. And this is why these first-hand accounts by people, whether they're still alive now or passed away, are so important.
But this story isn't just about Bletchley Park, is it?
Bletchley Park couldn't have done its work without the outstations where they had, for example, more of the bomb machines, the Y service, the people who listened in to enemy signals and copied them down and sent them for processing, the special communications units who were responsible for getting the intelligence reports from Bletchley Park to the senior people who needed them, the special liaison units who actually went up to the generals and said, sir, you ought to have a look at this report. There were people working in the Middle East, in India, in the Far East, a lot of them doing actual code-breaking work. So although it was controlled from Bletchley Park, Bletchley Park was very much the hub of it. By no means did it all take place at Bletchley Park.
It's a cliche, but this really is a race against time now, isn't it?
And one doesn't want to be morbid, but very often when we meet veterans, they're the first to remind us that we haven't got long to get their story. Yeah. They're quite frank about that. So the veterans who are still around are playing a fantastic part in helping us tell the story.
Your role is actually specifically as the Oral Archive.
Yeah, I'm the Oral History Officer, so it's specifically to run the Oral Archive, to carry out interviews myself, but also to run a team of very able volunteers who do a lot of the interviews for me. And those volunteers, without them, we just wouldn't be able to reach the numbers that we have over the last few years.
And that has really picked up, hasn't it, you were saying to me?
Oh, yes, yeah. I started the interviews about 3 years ago, almost, if you like, part-time while doing the Roll of Honour. And in the first 2 years, we interviewed about 100 people. In the last year, when we've sort of really upped the tempo, we've interviewed over 100 people in the past year. And there are loads more that we're in contact with, who we're arranging meetings with, that we're about to write to. We know are interested, so it's a matter of writing to them, telephoning them and asking if they're interested. And they all are. I mean, hardly anyone has said, no, thank you, I'd rather not. If they say that, then fine. We obviously respect that. But most are very, very keen to tell their story.
It is very rare to find a veteran who won't talk now. Yeah. I mean, we do have some who will not talk at
all.
There
are still people, to their credit, say it's secret and I can't talk about it. But it is actually official. It's from GCHQ. In fact, to be precise, if you look at the GCHQ website and then look at the bit about the Bletchley Park commemorative badge, there's a form for veterans who haven't yet got the commemorative badge, they can fill in and send to GCHQ to get the badge. It actually says something along the lines of anything that happened before the end of the war with Japan, you may regard as unclassified. In other words, you can talk about it. So it is official, they can talk about it. Occasionally people are a bit reluctant. We explain that they're able to talk about it. The other reason why they're reluctant is they think they haven't got much to say.
That's what we have all the time.
Yeah. I was only very junior. I didn't do much. Very often you ring somebody up and they say that, and then they immediately launch into a fantastic story about something they did or something that they got up to in their spare time. So I said, I'm afraid you've just talked yourself into an interview. And they usually give up then and say, yes, that's fine.
I think you're probably the same as us. We say to them, every single person connected either here or at the outstations, they're all a cog in a really huge machine.
Yeah. And as for the idea that they weren't important, well, of course they were. I mean, people think of the cryptanalysts, the people like Alan Turing, when they think of Bletchley Park. And we have interviewed a few people who had the educational qualifications that led them into that sort of work, the actual cracking of the codes. But we've interviewed cooks and drivers, people who in the Y service who took down the messages, the bomb operators. You know, without those, this place wouldn't have functioned, like any organisation. You know, however humble your job is supposed to be on paper, you are an important part of it. And just to make it absolutely clear, we'd like to interview anyone who is connected with this place, whatever job they did.
Because they don't actually realise how important their tiny role was in this bigger picture. I think when you say to them, no, you were, you know, you were part of this bigger machine, there's just a recognition of pride, isn't there?
The volunteers say it's an honour to be, you know, invited to people's houses and hear their stories. And you know, we are always made extremely welcome by all the veterans, yes.
We were made extremely welcome towards the end of November.
Yes.
We went down to Eastcote, didn't we?
The Worshipful, the Mayor, and Mayoress of Hillingdon, Councillor Catherine Dan and Mrs. Rita Kilroy, local councillors, ladies and gentlemen, may I first welcome you all to this unveiling ceremony. And thank you all so much for coming along to formally recognise the invaluable contribution made by the hundreds of people that worked on this site during the war and after the war. During World War II, the largest of the five outstations of the now very famous Bletchley Park was based here. It was known as HMS Pembroke 5 and housed over 100 bomb machines, as they were called, which were used for testing all the potential settings of the German Enigma machines. When the MOD announced 10 years ago that it was selling the site for development, several of the members of the Eastcote Residents Association and the Ruislip Northwood and Eastcote Local History Society were determined that the importance of the site should be recognised. Today, the memorial plaque that is going to be unveiled will provide a permanent reminder of the history for all to read. I hope this history has allowed you to appreciate the real significance of this site, and I would now like to hand you over to the Mayor of Hillingdon, Councillor Catherine Dan, for the unveiling.
I unveil this plaque in memory of the hundreds of unsung heroes whose valiant work at HMS Pembroke 5 made a very significant contribution to World War II, and also in memory of all the staff at GCHQ who worked here.
Thank you so much, Mayor Catherine. Thank you very much indeed. Two of the military organisations here, I thank very much for coming along, representatives from RAF Northolt and from the British Legion, would like to lay a wreath at this monument. I do thank everybody for coming along, the Mayor and the Mayoress, and also to thank all of you for coming along today, and just to mark the efforts of the many people who worked on this site and made this great country of ours safe for future generations. Thank you.
So we've just had the unveiling of the plaque at the former site of the Eastcote outstation, and with me I've got Chris Grew. And Chris, what's your association with this area and with the site?
Well, when it was announced that the site was going to be closed down and sold for private development, the Residents Association, together with the Local History Society here, felt that it was important somehow to mark, you know, the history of the site. And apart from this plaque which we've unveiled today, and with the help of GCHQ and others, we managed to name all the roads and all the buildings, in fact. So all the blocks of flats have all names associated with the history of the site. For example, in the centre of the square, the social club is called the Enigma Club, and the square is called Enigma Square. And the main road through the site is called Flowers Avenue, after Tommy Flowers.
And, Tommy, yeah.
And all through the development of the site, the Residents Association has had regular liaison meetings with the developers, Wimpy, to try and get, obviously, the best out of it for local residents. And then more recently, in fact, now, they formed up their own Residents Association, and they've called that the Pembroke Residents Association, and the site is now called Pembroke Park, when, in fact, originally, when we first knew it, and all the years I've lived here, it was called RAF Eastcote, when, in fact, it was a fairly anomalous, odd name, because, in fact, it really never was an RAF site.
Was it Lime Grove?
Lime Grove. During the war, before it became known as Pembroke Five, some people that worked here, we've heard this from an uncle, Russell Barnes, and a few other people that were here somewhere around the war, they knew it as Lime Grove. And then it became officially Pembroke Five in about 43.
I know a lot of the Wrens that we interview that were stationed here during the war, they all know it as just one thing, as Pembroke Five.
Yeah, because that was from sort of 43 or something onwards it became Pembroke Five. I mean, it's been a long time in the building, this site. I mean, they've been about 3 to 4 years in the building of the site. And they're just about finished now, so it seemed the appropriate time. If we put it in the middle of the estate, the ordinary public passing by on the main road wouldn't see it. And that's why it's down here, so people might refer to it and remember what it was all about.
I mean, that's the important thing, isn't it? The site couldn't be saved, but to be able to put this up, just so, as you say, people walk by, they will look at that and remember that such important work that was done here during World War II.
It was amazing to us. I've lived here since 1980 in the area. Right through from 80 till the late 90s, it appeared as if the site was closed and dead. And then for a little while, the American Marines that guarded the American Embassy in London were stationed here.
Oh, really?
And that was what I was referring to in a speech I mentioned, that we used to hear them chomping around the streets here on their early morning runs. But they left in 2006. Through an article we put in the local paper, we've had contact with some Wrens that were here. And it will allow the local history society just to maybe fill in a few more gaps for here.
So have you always had an interest in historical matters? Or just the fact
it's just I live here, and it's something that just seems important to me for Eastcote, really. You know, just making sure that these things aren't forgotten about completely. And I saw a letter in the Telegraph one day talking about, nobody's done anything to commemorate, not just here, but Bletchley Park and a lot of what the code breakers and others did. And I wrote quite a long letter explaining what we were doing here, but it was never published. It struck me as odd that somebody was writing in the Telegraph to say no one had ever bothered to commemorate any of these outstations when we were doing just that.
It took so long for Bletchley Park to get recognition and get into people's minds that sometimes people forget that we also do celebrate the vitally important work that was done at the outstations. Without these outstations, we couldn't have done what we did at Bletchley Park. And I can only congratulate you on what you've done. Thank you.
Thanks.
Have you been fighting to get this done for a long time?
Campaigning, about 10 years, actually, from when the site was first, we heard it was going to be redeveloped. And then when we heard Taylor Wimpy were going to develop it for housing, we realised that obviously all the history will be lost. So it's a joint project with the Eastcote Residents Association. I must stress that. So right from the beginning, I think both people in the residents and people in the local history society, people in both groups more or less came together at the same time and both had the same thoughts, and we collaborated and cooperated because both people were thinking on the same lines, really.
I think it's lovely that when you come around the estate, just little things like the streets are named.
Well, that was the first. Well, there were two main objectives. One, the obvious thing was because physically we couldn't save anything because they're really just prefabs. I mean, there's no buildings that you could preserve. But therefore, the only way we thought we could record the history was in the naming, the roads, and all the blocks of flats also have historical associations with the site, and having this plaque. But the plaque took much longer because it involved cooperation with Taylor Wimpy, and the management kept changing here. And right from the beginning, they said they'd view favourably, I think, after the site of that, but they never actually would commit themselves, so you had to keep
pushing and pushing, so that took a little while, the plaque. You had to just keep beaving away and keep reminding them. And
it's chipping away, isn't
chipping
it?
Chipping away, and doing like the background research to present, yeah, you know, to find suitable names for the roads and houses. And, of course, we had to get that approved by GCHQ, so we ran the names we'd sort of thought of past them, and one or two for security reasons they felt they didn't want us to use.
We still have secrets even now.
Yeah.
It's the work of people like you. It's very similar to the original trustees at Bletchley Park, just local...
Yes, it was a local campaign, really, because I don't think it was particularly well known outside the area. And a lot of people locally, of course, weren't even aware that there was ever any history, because, I mean, they just looked like government offices. I mean, people walked on the footpath through the site, but I don't think they're ever aware that anything had ever happened here of importance.
Which proves it worked well.
Oh, yes, because even during the war, I suspect hardly anyone locally realised what was happening here, because people kept the official secrets out, and, of course, it was all hidden from view from the footpath. I mean, you might have seen wrens, but it was when they were off duty, so they probably thought it was a... I think one of the wrens in her letter said they probably thought we were a wren's, you know, convalescent home or resting, because they just saw them relaxing in their residence.
I think that was one of the covers. I mean, there were a number of covers for so many of the
people just said, we're doing war work, didn't they? People didn't ask questions.
Yes, hush-hush is the favourite phrase that our ladies like to say.
Yes, right.
If anyone asked them, it's hush-hush. Yeah. And no one asked. Have you lived locally all your life?
Only since the early 1980s, yes. We've been here about 30 years.
So you've more or less moved here around the time.
So, I mean, when we moved here, the Americans were still on the base, and it was still, you know, government offices, but that's all I knew about it. I mean, I didn't know there was any history site till we started getting one or two inquiries, I think. From, I think, when members died, or people turning out effects, and they found these papers, you know, and say, what's this? You know,
and well, it was only around that time that the
and
secret
then I
was
think
first
that secret, one of them, was it Peter Wright? Who was the one that first? You know,
Frank Winterbottom's book came out in
1974. And then people started putting two together, and they realised some things that their relatives had said.
I mean, it's things like this that commemorate that amazing dedication from those people, both men and women. A lot of people don't realise that 75% of the people working at Bletchley Park and its outstations were women.
Oh, yes.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Was there a point where you knew finally it was going to happen and you'd get the plaque? And how did that feel?
Oh, that was very satisfying. Probably about 2 years ago when we had the definite say-so from Taylor Rubin that they would, and there was a new site manager and they agreed a site for it, so we felt things had finally, you know, we got a definite decision, because up till then it would just be, yes, we're thinking about it, or yes, it's a good idea, but nothing concrete ever happens. Yes, and then we could go ahead and actually order, because we didn't want to order the plaque till we knew that Taylor Wimpey were going to provide the plinth, really.
Exactly,
I mean, it was down to them.
Or even a site to put it.
Or a site to put it, and because originally I think it was going to be near the main road, but this is a much better site.
I mean, it's the dedication of people like you that make these things happen.
Yeah.
So thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
They worked for a long time to get that plaque put up in Eastcote, didn't they?
Yes, they did, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's nice that even though that entire part of our collective Bletchley Park history has been built over and wiped out, it is still being remembered, isn't it?
Oh, yes, definitely, yeah. It's great that they're aware of what happened there. They're very well briefed on what Eastcote did and how it contributed to Bletchley Park. And I'm very pleased on behalf of the veterans to see one of the outstations is being properly recognised, helping to recognise the fact that people work very hard at other places, and Eastcote in particular.
It's not just the technical things we want to know, because we know an awful lot of those. Would you say more the social side of things?
Very much the human, not the social side of it. We hear about where people lived, whether they were the wrens billeted in Woburn Abbey. People billeted locally with families, fantastic stories of people billeted with a family from, if you like, a different social class from what they were used to, but becoming lifelong friends, which is marvellous. We also get a lot of detail that we can use for telling the story in the museum here. One particular one was when we were working to rebuild the huts, I interviewed a lady who had worked actually in Hut 6 itself, and she, as well as telling us about the work, she recounted about how they had the big brick blast walls around the huts, and how they used to, on a nice day, go and sit on top of the walls and watch the tennis courts. And so anyone who's been to Bletchley Park will remember Hut 6, next door, the tennis courts. So that, of course, helped with deciding that the walls were there. Yeah. And, of course, as you know, last year they suddenly reappeared.
Fantastic. How can people contact you?
Probably the easiest way is to go to the Bletchley Park website, bletchleypark.org. vetvet.uk, and there's an inquiry form on there. So if you find that and say, you know, I'm a veteran or I know a veteran, and would you be interested in interviewing her, that will certainly reach me.
Now, obviously, in a perfect world, we would have infinite time and infinite number of volunteers to do this. And in the past, Bletchley Park didn't have the funding to do this. They do now. And in that intermediate time, there may have been people who fell through the cracks, possibly.
Yeah, I'm sure there are people who've been in touch with us and said they'd like to be interviewed. If you've done that and you haven't heard back from us, please contact us again. We're not ignoring you. It's just, to be honest, we get so many people contacting us that we can't always keep up with them. So please, please do get in touch. We're not ignoring you, and we would love to hear from you again.
One of the many veterans who've shared their memories for future generations is Roseanne Colchester, who arrived at Bletchley Park in 1942. First, she worked on Italian Air Force codes and later moved on to Japanese. She's described it since as that terrible war.
It's all grown up much more. I mean, many more huts, many more sort of substantial-looking huts than there used to be.
The Naffy hut was just sort of where the...
Naffy hut was there?
Yes.
So coming out from the... war, there was always a crowd of people around it. It used to come up to it like coming to a pub, you know, coming to a bar, open air bar.
And when did you first come here?
1942.
You were an early one then.
Well, it had started in 1940.
A lot of the people we meet these days are quite late on Wrens from sort of 44, 45.
Oh, yes.
Do you want to come into hut 6?
Let's go and see what's inside. Yes. Hello. Thank you.
And just to the left there is where Gordon Welshman used to work.
We weren't allowed to ask anybody else's name in those days.
You wouldn't have been able to come into this hut, would you?
No, wouldn't be allowed to come in. Never talk to them about their job, never ask what they were doing. Never allowed to go into anybody else's hut. Completely.
And you just did that. It was second nature, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, we were given a pep talk at first, and so by Tom Bowes, who was a professor, and he said, you must never, never ask anybody what they're doing. You mustn't ask them, and you mustn't even ask their name. You know, just your house is where you work, that's it.
And everyone stuck to it.
So secret, yes.
What work were you doing?
I was doing Italian Air Force, and we were finding out bombers, where they were going, and the S-82, S-81, DEP, something, Mesmer through, and then arrive for Sicily, so on and so forth. And we were to try and get through to the air stations in North Africa, and then they shot them luck.
Is this while Malta was in the stage?
Yes, yeah. And the North African War was on.
Yes. So at night, would it have been this dark?
No. They had sort of bars of brilliant light.
You were in a slightly different style of hut, weren't you?
Yes.
They had fluorescent lights.
Very tiring for the eyes. Mm. I got an eye strain and had to sort of go away for a week. So something about the flickering of the lights, it was very difficult.
A lot of the ladies who worked on Colossus say the same thing. They would have to have breaks where they would go off and convalesce for a week.
Yes, that's right. We really got a terrible eye strain. But it was a wonderful place. I adored being here. I mean, I was very young, only 19. And it was the first time I'd been away from home. And one just was here, all in my village in Penny Stratford. And I used to bicycle up from there every day.
It would have been an adventure, wouldn't it, I suppose?
Yes, it was rather an adventure.
So were you 19 when you started?
Yes. And made very good friends, wonderful friends for life. Yeah, fortunately, they're all dead now.
Unfortunately, yeah. I was just going to say, because a lot of the ladies I speak to, they say exactly the same thing. They had friends they made here, they had for the rest of their lives.
Yes,
but
unfortunately,
a lot of them have passed on.
Because we were all so very close together, because we weren't able to ask other people what they were doing or say, which hut are you in? So we didn't really know anybody else, except people in our own hut. We weren't encouraged to know anybody
And
else.
It's like the Wrens, the people on the same watch as them, they would be their friends.
Yes, exactly, yes.
So you were doing really interesting work then.
Well, I suppose I was. You know, it was Air Force work. I was in the Air Force section, and we were doing the departure and the arrival in their various destinations, all these bombers and things from North Africa, intercepting them.
I mean, that was absolutely vital in 1941.
It was terribly exciting sometimes. I mean, the feeling in the office when you knew you were ahead of the timetable and they hadn't yet taken off, and you were able to get the message through to night fighters, and then they'd go up and shoot them down. And then, really, that was a wonderful feeling of triumph. I never thought that the poor men were being killed, but still, there we are.
It's the fact that in you doing that, you've probably saved,
countless lives
if they were going to bomb a convoy on its way to Malta. I mean, for example, my stepdad might have been on one of those ships.
Really?
He was on HMS Victorious. He was Fleet Air Arm.
Oh, yes.
So you might have helped save him.
Yeah, probably did.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your service.
That's sweet.
No, it's one of the nice connections that me personally I have for here is that a lot of the work here, Mick did 18 convoy duties. And I've no doubt at some point something here
probably did, especially for the naval section, which is another, not this hut, I think it wasn't.
Well, especially with the aircraft carriers, they were trying to keep away from the bombers, because the dive bombers were always trying to get them.
Yes, they were, indeed. I was in the Air Force section, which was connected with always with Air Force things. So he didn't much know about the naval part.
Is this the same sort of furniture that you had
Yes, it is, but it's sort of... I think we had something, had lino or something on the floor.
Yes, they just had floorboards in here, didn't they?
Yes. Well, they had floorboards, and I think they had a sort of lino over the top. It didn't seem to be so noisy.
I think you were in a lap of luxury compared to in here. What do you think to how they renovated the place?
Well, it's very like it was, yes. It is.
Does it take you back at all?
My room was bigger. It was about this one again, and then there was a big bookcase. And then behind that was one of the people who was working there.
Hello, good to see you back. How are you?
All right, thank you. Good, yes.
Enjoying it?
Very nice, have a very nice lunch. Good. On our tour.
All right, I won't disturb you, crack on. Weren't you in Hut 3?
I wasn't in Hut 3 ever. I was in Hut A over there. In the main...
In Block A?
Block A.
But the furniture's correct.
Furniture's correct. Good, excellent.
Yes. Can we get out this way? Yes, we can. I was in that hut first, in that hut. And then I went to Block A, over there, the houses. Mm. And then Block F, which was right out in the fields then. It was up there. Yeah, that was my last port of call.
And then, yes, because by then it would have been 1945.
Then it was 1945, yes.
That's marvellous.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, where we are at BPark Podcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.